And our sermon text today is Ecclesiastes 2, 12 through 17. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then that I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For the wise, for of the wise as of the fool, there was no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. We are familiar with many of our founding fathers. Their names are ubiquitous: George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, John Adams. Yet there's one whose name is conspicuous because of its absence. Do you know who that might be? Historians are agreed that the luminous founding father who has been largely forgotten is George Mason, a delegate to the Constitutional Convention from Virginia. The best biography of him is by Jeff Broadwater, and its title is George Mason, Forgotten Founder. Do you know why he's considered so crucial to crafting the Constitution and making it what it is today? Mason was the author of the Virginia Bill of Rights that became the basis for our own Bill of Rights. And although the Constitution was ratified eventually without a Bill of Rights, what we know now is that the 10 Bill of Rights was added later to as the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, primarily because of Mason's persuasive argumentation. And although he was a slave owner himself, Mason fought for the banning of further importation of slaves and the extension of slavery into other territories. He also insisted that there should be no state church, which was novel in that day, and that the government should not financially support any single church. This forgotten founder has slowly been getting his due now in the recent past. George Mason University recently built a memorial to him. That one hasn't been torn down yet. And finally, a bas-relief sculpture of him in the House chamber, along with 22 other great lawmakers, has just been installed to just above and to the right of the speaker's chair. Now, Broadwater's book is a good read, perhaps the most thorough work on this founding father to date. How does someone so crucial, however, go unnoticed for so long? How can his remembrance so fade from our collective memory? How many other great ones lie in relative obscurity in their graves, while what they have done, said, and accomplished goes unnoticed and unsung by subsequent generations? We don't know, of course, because by definition, if they're forgotten, we don't remember or know them, right? In reality, we must say that this phenomenon is easily susceptible and frequent, too. Solomon makes it an explicit point in his work before us today, as he seeks to breed wisdom within the heart and mind of his succeeding sons. Will they rule wisely? Will their labors endure past one fleeting generation? Will their memory be famous? Infamous, maybe, or lost to antiquity. To this conundrum, Koheleth now addresses himself. There are three points I want to make with you regarding our text today. The inside flap of your bulletin, you have a brief outline if you want to take some notes. Point number one, forgotten is our title, forgotten. The wise king knows that wisdom is better than folly, even though it is forgotten by the next king. Verses 12 and 13. Now, as we've observed for you in the past, we're in mid-stride here in chapter 2. The book of Ecclesiastes is a universal composition. It deals with a wide range of human experience that all men encounter. Remember his mission. He said in chapter 1, verse 13, I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. And chapter 1 is largely an introduction to his themes and his method, too. He has particular themes and a method by which he goes about them. His themes, four basic ones. First of all is vapor. All is vapor. That's the literal translation of the Hebrew word hebel. English translations render it commonly as vanity, as the King James or the English Standard, or meaninglessness, as the NIV puts it. And although we can still arrive at a more or less proper conclusion using these translations, they're impediments. And the literal rendering is far more preferred, if you will. That is vapor. Because it vividly communicates that which Koheleth wishes to say. All we count as enduring is really brief and transitory. Okay? Second theme. For the sake of argument, he tells us, I restrict myself to that which is observable under the sun. Under the sun. Reoccurs all through Ecclesiastes. So much of what Solomon experiences, frustration, exasperation, even hatred, can be attributed to the ultimate brevity of everything. Everything that happens in this life, owing to the nature of the curse, right, primarily, always lurking behind that which transpires that is so vaporous. His deliberate use of this phrase, under the sun, eventually begs the response as well, well, then, pray tell, what about above the sun, right? And he's prodding us towards that by not using it explicitly, but nevertheless pointing us in that direction. Third major theme. There's much sweet nectar in the flower of life, okay? Not meaningless, it's not despairing, it's not vain. There's much sweet nectar in the flower of life. As Koheleth takes up each component of life, he will pronounce it good. When guided by wisdom, work, we've already seen a little bit of that, right? Work, pleasure, love, life are all good and sweet, albeit fleeting. And fourthly, there's nothing new under the sun as well. Now, given the evidence presented to us under the sun, that's predicate, right? Given the evidence presented us under the sun, all we can conclude is that life is progressively cyclical. That is, repeats, but moves as well, going toward an end. What has been will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun, he says. Four major themes, two major approaches in method, okay? Number one. I am an empiricist, and that I test all by experience, he tells us. He doesn't use the word empiricist, of course. I am an empiricist, though, by nature. The empiricist will follow after Solomon in method, right? I am an empiricist in that I test all by experience. Solomon doesn't leave anything to hearsay or knowledge by word of mouth. He experiences all about which he pronounces judgment by direct experience. Work, pleasure, sex, power, wealth are all plumbed to their depths by Solomon personally. He says, I have seen everything that is done under the sun. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure. Whatever he concludes because he knows it to his toenails. The second prong to his method, I am a biblicist in that I test all by wisdom. He tells us, in effect, I am a biblicist in that I test all by wisdom. Despite what other commentators speculate, Solomon's wisdom never leaves him. He tells us that. Even when he ironically plumbs folly, his wisdom doesn't leave him. He says, my wisdom remained with me, my heart still guiding me with wisdom through all of this. And as we observed last week, there's no reason to take these statements and others like them as ironic. But you have to do that if you translate Hebel as vanity or meaninglessness rather than as indeed vapor. So, they must be taken on their face, these statements that he tests all by wisdom and his wisdom never leaves him. And let me also remind you of the genre of this book. It is wisdom literature. It has a target audience, Solomon's sons, who must follow after him. Solomon deliberately constructed Ecclesiastes as a conundrum, a kind of conundrum, which is a riddle, especially with a pun in the answer, a puzzling question, as the Oxford English Dictionary puts it, defines it. It would require thought and labor, wise reflection to unravel and apply to the living, present circumstances that his sons would face subsequent to his demise. And there are no glib, easy answers in this book. Its wisdom does not lie on the surface, easily skimmed as if cream surfacing at the top. It is not susceptible to proof texting. Much of this is evident in our text today. He said, so I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the man do who comes after the king? The idea of the man emphasized here. What can the man do who comes after the king? Who is the man? Emphatic in the text. Who is the man? Implicitly, he is the one who comes after Solomon, the inheritor of the throne of David. This is one of the keys that indicates Ecclesiastes was composed for his sons, kings who would come after him. What then precisely is it that sons following him can do? Only what has already been done, he says. Only what has already been done. This is one of the recurring motifs of Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun. What has been will be, and what will be is even now. Therefore, if Koheleth can test wisdom fully, will not the path of his successors be made much easier? Solomon, having walked all the paths of life for his sons, or before his sons, he can't walk it for them, but he can walk it before them. If indeed they will only reprise what Solomon has done, they will be able to rule this people wisely, as Solomon pleaded to God for him to do. And this is precisely why he can conclude unreservedly, then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than folly, as there's more gain in light than in darkness. He's not being ironic here, okay? He won't take that back later by saying, oh, all is vain, right? All is useless. No. If he gets it right, and his sons follow in his footsteps, certain blessings will flow. This is the constant theme of the wisdom literature, too, isn't it? Proverbs begins by saying, hear my son, your father's instruction. Proverbs, also written by Solomon for his sons, and consequently, ergo, for our sons, too. Okay? Psalm 2. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ecclesiastes will conclude by saying, my son. Ecclesiastes 12, my son, beware of anything beyond these, that is the Proverbs he has already given us. For all men, wisdom pays more dividends than folly. One's life is more fruitful, filled with less evil, and blessed by God far more than if he had followed the way of the fool. This is not ironic. It is not disingenuous, self-deceived blather. It's not that. Meant to really indicate that Solomon is off track and really behaving like a fool. No. This tack only makes sense as worthless hash of the text, if indeed you translate vanity or uselessness, right? No. Kohelet's conclusion is in full consonance with the rest of wisdom literature, all right? The path of the righteous, as Proverbs chapter 4 tells us, the path of the righteous is like the light of dawn, which shines brighter and brighter until the full day. The way of the wicked is like deep darkness. They do not know over what they stumble. Once again, light and darkness contrasted, right? Proverbs 22:3 says, the prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it. You remember from John, our Lord says, Jesus said to them, the light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who walks in the darkness does not know where he is going. Our Lord reprising wisdom literature constantly throughout his ministry here in particular. So, Solomon is not saying something here that he'll take back later. This is full-orbed truth about wisdom. He's not schizophrenic. Neither am I. Demonstrating one personality and mode of thinking here, optimistic and affirmative, and then later throwing up his hands and exclaiming in despair, all is vain and empty and fruitless. No. He is commending for his sons, and by extension our sons, us and our sons, that wisdom truly is better than folly. It garners more gain and is as different as light is from darkness. This is an overarching biblical truth. It is not hedged, chiseled, or denigrated in Ecclesiastes. And it will be tempered and qualified, though. It will be tempered and qualified in the human heart, but not dispensed with as a rule of life. What he will observe for us is a truth that every lost man knows to his toenails as well. Wisdom is fleeting. It is as fleeting, as ephemeral, as vapor when remembered by the next generation, he's telling us. Forgetfulness is the rule. Remembrance, the exception. Wisdom thus retains all of its intrinsic value. It is the vaporous communication of it to the next generation that makes things so hateful. This truth, then, is fleshed out for us in the following verses. I hope you have this clear and straight now. It's not wisdom that's being denigrated and saying vain and meaningless, no. It's the vaporousness of it and the forgetfulness of its communication to the next generation. And this truth is fleshed out for us in the following verses, verses 14 and 15.2. Forgotten. The wise knows that he can make his way, even though his end is as imminent as the fool. They share that in common. Following up on his previous reflections, Koheleth crafts an apt proverb. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. The preacher, he will conclude in Ecclesiastes, the preacher or Koheleth also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. This is one of them. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Here, Solomon underlines the theme of wisdom noticed previously. The man who diligently seeks wisdom proceeds along life's path as if illumined by light, while the fool stumbles around in thick darkness. But our persistent theme of the fleeting, ephemeral nature of all things and its consequent impact on the human heart are magnified for us here. And yet, that is in contrast. Bubbling up within his breast is vexation, sorrow, yea, hatred. Here the great utility and efficacy of wisdom is tempered. I perceived, he says, that is with the employment of wisdom, his wisdom never leaves him. I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Now the Hebrew word for event, crucial here, the Hebrew word for event is not limited to one single isolated happening, but can also involve a series of events or a process. Continuous time nature here. The question then arises, what is the event to which Koheleth refers? We're going to take a departure from most commentators here again. Most commentators see the event as death. Ultimately, yes. But do not ignore the major motif in to which Koheleth refers here in the text. Both the wise and the fool are forgotten. That's our title today, and that's the motif throughout this text today. Both the wise and the fool are forgotten. This is in the forefront of his thinking and the forefront of his exasperations, too. He says, for of the wise as of the fool, there's no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. Forgetting. Koheleth has been building towards this conclusion. We have to read along with him. He's been building toward this conclusion. It looms over each of these verses. While wisdom indeed excels over folly, no one remembers either the man or his wisdom. He's already told the parable of that man, right? The wise man of the city who delivered the city by his wisdom, but nobody remembered. The remembrance of that wisdom. And the wisdom itself passes as swiftly as the vapor of the wise man's life. Solomon sees here prophetically that the failure of his program when it comes to his own sons. No sooner will Solomon reach room temperature than Rehoboam will foolishly take the counsel of the young men over the older ones. We have that account in 1 Kings chapter 12, where it says, then King Rehoboam took counsel with the old men who had stood before Solomon and his father, the wise ones, right? While he was yet alive, saying, how do you advise me to answer this people? And they said to him, if you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them when you answer them, then they will be your servants forever. But, oh, the tragic but. But he abandoned the counsel that the old men gave him and took counsel with the young men who had grown up with him and stood before him. And he said to them, what do you advise that we answer this people who have said to me, lighten the yoke that your father put on us? And these young bucks, not the literal translation, the young men who had grown up with him said to him, thus shall you speak to this people who said to you, your father made our yoke heavy, but you lighten it for us. Thus you shall say to them, my little finger is thicker than my father's thighs. And now, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. Sounds like a young kid, doesn't it? Full of himself. Precisely what Rehoboam did. No wonder Koheleth is grieved. Despite his assiduous labor over this work, composed with great skill in order to sharpen and hone his son's skills in ruling this people, the very first decision that son makes is folly. He behaves the fool, for which all of God's people would suffer for generations hence. Tell me, in what sense was Solomon forgotten? In what sense was Solomon forgotten? Did Rehoboam forget the memory of his father? Did he have some deficiency of memory, perhaps early onset of Alzheimer's, that caused him to obliterate his recollection of his father and the neurons of his brain? No. But he did forget in the biblical sense. The Hebrew word for to remember is zakar. And there is a zakar motif throughout Scripture, the idea of remembering, remembrance. That is, one remembers God's covenant so as to obey. This is why the idea of covenant is so important in Scripture. Because zakar means one remembers God's covenant so as to obey, to keep its ordinances and be faithful to the suzerain who cut it with you. All of that is bound up with remembering, with zakar. And then on his part, God remembers so as to bless those who are faithful and curse those who disobey and forget him in the biblical sense. Rehoboam did not experience early onset of dementia, but rather the overwhelming consent to depravity. He forgot in precisely the covenant sense that his father feared he would, and in the way in which Solomon observed all foolish kings do forget. How blessed and fortunate we are, right? Today, we're so much wiser, living in an enlightened age under such wise and enlightened princes. But of course, when considered, we see that our generation is no different. We have forgotten as well. In fact, our generation seems to be honing the skill of covenant forgetfulness. Do you know the concept of historical blackout? Historical blackout, historians use this term frequently. It's the deliberate strategy of inculcating forgetfulness in a populace by ignoring and revising their history so as to manipulate that history and then manipulate them. Classic book in this regard is Harry Elmer Barnes, who wrote a book back in the 50s, Revisionism and the Historical Blackout, and a historian using this historical term. And it chronicles this process in our own country when it comes to our economy and the Constitution, statist progressives who inhabit our institutions of learning and governance have deliberately distorted the small government free market economy envisioned by our founders and blacked out its memory from generations of public school students, haven't they? You saw the product of historical blackout and indoctrination in the streets during the George Floyd riots. You see the product of historical blackout and indoctrination with Antifa, ironically fighting fascists and Nazis when they are behaving in the very same way. You see the product of historical blackout and indoctrination in those tearing down statues. Mason recently gone up. How long will his last? Tearing down statues of better men than themselves. Virtue signaling their ignorance. So, even though the biblical roots of that constitution and economy have long been forgotten and distorted when remembered, aren't they? The names of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, or John Adams have been expunged. Have they been expunged from our collective memories? No, but most certainly what they taught, believed, and bequeathed to us in the Constitution and its principles have been forgotten. Do you know what the party slogan was in George Orwell's 1984? The party slogan was, "He who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past." Very profound. Orwell understood his generation. In fact, the sole job of 1984's protagonist, Winston Smith, was to change and alter the record of the past. Change and alter the record of the past according to the needs of Big Brother and the party in the present. A hero today could be a scoundrel the next. A beloved party member from generation past could suddenly evaporate from the collective memory for all intents and purposes never having existed. 1984. This is the sense in which Solomon means there's no enduring remembrance. The very same sense. There is no enduring remembrance. As the philosopher Hegel said, what we learn from history is that man doesn't learn anything from history. To the ephemeral nature of wisdom, the absolute ephemeral nature of wisdom among princes, Solomon gives his lament and refrain. I said in my heart that this also is vanity. No, not vanity, vapor. Vapor translates that much better. It doesn't rob what he's just given. Vanity, meaningless, does. I said in my heart that this also is vapor. That is, not that wisdom is futile and fruitless and vain, but that it doesn't last, does not endure, but comes and goes as quickly as our dust devil at craters of the moon. You ever seen a dust devil at craters of the moon? Eerie. It's as fleeting as a lovely rainbow mist floating off of the Mesa Falls. That's a beautiful sight if you've never been to Mesa Falls. Wisdom is as ephemeral as the approval numbers for a failed president. Not only does this attain for government, but it also obtains for each and every human being that is in possession of a modicum of wisdom and sense. And that brings us to point number 3, verses 16 and 17. Forgotten. The wise king knows that generations hence will not remember, even though this brings him sorrow. Note how Koheleth underlines and emphasizes the motif of forgetfulness, such that even the death of men serves this theme. How the wise dies just like the fool. The emphasis is not upon death, qua death, but on its manner. The wise die in the great sea of forgetfulness just like the fool. Just like the fool. I'm sure all of us can understand this in some sense. I remember my mother and father very vividly and fondly. Not a day that goes by that I don't, such that I try to model their positive traits and eschew their negative traits. I see their faces. I remember their mannerisms and their habits. I can hear their voices echo in my memory, and I remember their touch, such that I can still feel the roughness of my father's beard, the softness of my mother's cheek. I remember my parents. I also remember my grandparents, but far less distinctly. My father's father was a simple, hard-working man who loved the Lord. I always remember him as a wise and good man. His father, my great-grandfather, I never knew. I have no knowledge of him except a few vague references to his early death and alcoholism that he emigrated from Ireland. He was never held up in our family circles as a particularly positive role model. And what of generations of Basses previous to this? I have little to no idea. They're all lost to me in the mists of forgetfulness. There you have it. The sum of their lives and memory and wisdom. You'll never know them and could care less. You have enough to deal with in your own families. All of the bitter experiences, joyous conquests, victories, and wisdom gleaned from experiences accumulated over some 223 years. The sum, as near as I can reckon, of my father, grandfather, great-grandfather's lives, 223 years. Summarized, concentrated in a few brief memories and bromides of me, a son of the Bass family. of my great-grandfather, yea, my great-great-grandfather, the words of Koheleth are true. There's no enduring remembrance. Soon, even the memory of my wise grandfather and my foolish great-grandfather will fade, too, and slip into that great sleepy sea of forgetfulness. Of course, that will never happen to me, I flatter myself. I'll have a marble stone statue built and insist that my kids haul it around wherever they go and put it in the living room. I'll write books, I'll become famous and set Olympic records and compose symphonies that will be played centuries hence, and I'll be immortal then, right? I'll be immortal then, huh? In college, I had a girlfriend who was a painter. She hoped to achieve a measure of immortality by having her work hanging in the galleries of the world next to Van Gogh and Vermeer and Monet in London and Paris and New York. Fine aspiration for a young painter. Over the years, I've lost track of her, but I haven't seen her work or heard of it in any of those places. Trouble is, even then, if she had achieved this kind of immortality, she'd be subject to the indignities of historical blackout. That is, the indoctrinated climate activists who give blue themselves to or throw soup at Van Goghs and Vermeers and Monets, right? Well, this is what constitutes the worldling's immortality, isn't it? The worldling's immortality. But even then, one day, even these will be forgotten too. Will they not? As the philosopher Paul Tillich puts it, he says, in the depths of the anxiety of having to die is the anxiety of being eternally forgotten. Tillich was an existentialist for whom all of life consisted in life under the sun, right? That's all he knew. Another said, the worst part about loneliness isn't being alone, it's being forgotten. Here's one every broken heart can understand. True loneliness is being forgotten by someone you can't forget. That's pathetic, isn't it? True loneliness is being forgotten by someone you can't forget. Well, for Koheleth, as for all men who think past their noses, the gut response here is his and ours. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. Not because wisdom is turned on its head, but because it is fleeting. Once more, he returns to his world under the sun. Under the sun. That life that is lived apart from a word from God. That life where revelation from above is silent and unseen and unrecorded. Where that life is as ignorant and forgotten as the memories of Eden. This place, this world, this life that we know is such that it is as if we live in a Tupperware piece with a lid on. We live under the lid, under the sun. Now, all of us can relate to this, can't we? All of us can relate to this. Either your neighbors, your friends, your relatives, all of us can relate to this, including you. But you also know something better. What can you do? Well, the solution to this riddle, this puzzle, this conundrum, is to point men to the one who does remember and whose remembrance spells life for those remembered, precisely because he is the author of life. Our psalm today said, from Psalm 112, the righteous man will never be shaken. He will be remembered forever. And this is what God does, brothers and sisters, for the righteous remembers them. But don't forget, he doesn't forget the unrighteous either. If you think you go to hell and be forgotten, I'm sorry, you will not be forgotten. You will be remembered so as to be covenantally cursed. God is a covenant God. He blesses very consciously the righteous and the unrighteous. You will be remembered in hell, remembered so as to be cursed and punished. So no man gets away with being forgotten in the sense of Tillich's being forgotten. All of us can relate to this, and we can articulate this for our friends, our neighbors, and our families. One who does remember, God is, and it spells life for those remembered, precisely because he is the author of life. Malachi puts it this way, "Then those who feared the Lord spoke with one another. The Lord paid attention and heard them, and a book of remembrance was written before him of those who feared the Lord and esteemed his name, remembering so as to bless," God is. "They shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, in the day when I make up my treasured possession, and I will spare them as a man spares his son who serves him. Then once more you shall see the distinction between the righteous and the wicked, between the one who serves God and the one who does not serve him." All right? To this you must call those despairing, those grieved by life, who hate it because they too see life under the sun as but a vapor. Declare to them that there will be a day above the sun when books of remembrance are opened and God will remember the wicked to curse eternally and he will remember the righteous to bless eternally with life with him in the New Jerusalem. May you continue to remember his covenant and be found in that day above the sun, remembered by your Creator and Redeemer. Let us now come to that place where we are commanded to remember, not to just think warm, fuzzy thoughts about Christ and his death, but remember so as to obey and remain faithful as we come to the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.